Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love. In this episode, we spoke with Sam Goodwin, entrepreneur, author, and international keynote speaker known for his thought leadership on embracing uncertainty. Sam recently published his book, Saving Sam, which recounts his experience of being taken hostage and wrongfully imprisoned in Syria. Sam shares with us the power of resiliency and embracing faith in times of struggle. Sam, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Thanks for having me.
So I would love it if you could just start and tell us your story about, just kind of your life. And you have this new book coming out and kind of what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in St. Louis in the Midwest in the United States. I played hockey most of my life and was fortunate to play in college. And then after that, I had an opportunity to move overseas. I began my professional career in Singapore, and I originally only planned to be there for about 3 months, but ended up staying for 6 years. And it was a great way to begin my professional career. I was working for a tech startup company and an NGO that was doing development work around Southeast Asia. And during that time, I traveled as much as I could, and I didn't really like to repeat places. So, holidays and weekends, I would just take advantage of being in Southeast Asia and having the world's best airport in my backyard. And in early 2018, I realized I'd traveled to about 120 countries in the world. And the competitive athlete in me kind of kicked in and thought, well, how many are there? Maybe I could go to all of them. And for me, travel was always about learning and discovery, and it was the best education I've ever had. It was never about ticking boxes, but the style of travel changed just a little bit, and I decided to pursue the goal. And like any worthwhile venture or endeavor in life, it wasn't without its challenges. And in 2019, when I was in Syria, I was taken hostage and held by the Syrian regime on suspicion of being a spy and collaborating with terrorists. And they held me for 9 weeks in some pretty uncomfortable situations. Thank God, thanks to a long list of people who worked tirelessly, it ended peacefully. And in the wake of that, it's kind of shifted my perspective on a lot of things. And I've really tried to reflect on that and pull out lessons and messages that I think can be helpful to others. And again, has really shifted my trajectory in a lot of different paths in life, both personally, professionally, spiritually. And that was, I don't want to be known for the things that happened to me. I want to be known for the way I've responded to them. And that's really the basis of this book that I'm releasing. It talks about kind of my travel journey, but a lot about captivity and kind of what I was going through and what my family was going through. And on one hand, it's this unforgettable story that includes, a travel journey to every country in the world, celebrities, heads of state, high stakes diplomacy. But on the other hand, and perhaps more importantly, it's about what we all learn through this experience that we think can be helpful to others today. It's about how we can all turn our own challenges and adversities into assets. So that's really where my path is today. I have the book coming out, and I now speak full-time, and that's kind of how things look for me right now, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Wow. So I mean, that's a very heavy thing to I mean, for someone, just looking into your story and being captive from in a different country, away from your family, all those things. Can you, talk about a little bit what those challenging moments were that you eventually write about in your book, but like some of those most challenging moments and then how you overcame them?
Yeah, sure. So I found myself in a situation where everything had been taken from me, my communication, my material possessions, my freedom. And during this time, I found strength in several ways. I leaned on perspectives that I had developed from traveling to different corners of the world, which provoked gratitude for just the basic food and water I was being given. For example, I had encountered a lot of people around the world who don't have access to those things. I leaned on skills and traits I developed from being a competitive athlete. The mental toughness, critical thinking, resilience. You know, how often have we had a boss or a coach tell us, control the things you can control, right? I leaned on a belief that I had a purpose in life, and I leaned on a desire to see family and friends again. Most importantly, though, I leaned on my faith. As I said, everything had been taken from me, but I knew that my faith was absolute. That's what I had to hold on to when everything else had been taken. And my prayers became this uninterrupted conversation with God. I was constantly talking to him, pacing back and forth in this dungeon, saying things out loud. Even though the guards told me not to talk, I said, God, I'm here. I'm listening. What are you trying to tell me today? What can I learn today? What are perhaps the positives about my situation today? And my number one prayer was always, God, please keep my situation safe and peaceful. Please keep me physically unharmed. My second prayer was then about the timeline. So if this was all going to end peacefully, then my next question was when. And frankly, Mary, this prayer was the one that became the most tricky and intense. And I remember almost positioning it as like a business deal. I said, God, I know you have a plan, but is it possible? Would you consider an adjustment to the timeline? Can that work with your plan? And then I finished all of my prayers by saying the rosary. I would dedicate each decade to something different. I prayed for my family and my friends and anybody who I thought might be working to get me out of the situation. I prayed for world peace. I prayed very hard for the courage to forgive my captors. And through that, I discovered that I was working to forgive people who weren't even sorry. And that's strength. Forgiveness, I discovered, it is not a feeling. It's a choice. So there were a range of things that I leaned on for strength, as I kind of described there.
Wow. I'm sorry. Can you tell us again how long you were there?
Yeah. So they held me for 9 weeks, for 63 days, which at the time felt like an eternity.
Yeah.
I learned very quickly that in the hostage space and the wrongful detainee space, that was actually lightning fast, especially in Syria. Oftentimes these cases go on for much longer, oftentimes for years. I mean, we have Evan Gershkovitz in Russia right now, who's been there for well over a year. There's the hostages in Gaza right now who are it's been 9 months or however long it's been since October 7th. Mm-hmm. So felt like an eternity, but I've learned that I was incredibly fortunate on that front.
Mm-hmm. Was there anyone else with you that you could, I don't know, I feel like with captivity and isolation, that can really put a toll on you. Was there anyone else with you in those moments?
Yeah, my time was split. So the first month I was held in solitary confinement, totally isolated. I was held in solitary confinement for 27 days for the first month. And that is torture. It's designed to break you. It's a cruel tactic that's been used by captors for centuries. I was then moved, and in the second month held with lots of other people. And that was unquestionably an upgrade, but had its own challenges, from, you know, no privacy to trying to manage these often crazy relationships. So my time was kind of split on that front, and that was kind of how that was structured.
Right. And how did you, let's say in those moments of isolation, or even in the midst of kind of not really, you know, with a ton of other people, how did you maintain that, your hope and resilience? You said you prayed the rosary, but did you have communication with your family in this midst of this time?
So I never had any communication with anybody outside this during the entire time. Well, there was a couple instances where I managed to smuggle out just a little bit of communication. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple touch points where I had a tiny bit of communication, but essentially Essentially, no. And one of the things that I think about quite a bit, and I think it's relevant to the theme of this podcast, is, as I mentioned, I found myself in a situation where everything had been taken, but I knew that my faith was absolute. I knew I could lean on it for strength. And I'm so grateful to my parents for instilling a strong Catholic faith into myself and my four younger siblings throughout our entire life. And they taught us to work on our faith every day, all the time. And as a result of that, it was there for me when I had nothing else. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we can just expect that strength and that support to be there for us when we need it, if we don't work on it all the time. It's not just going to magically be there. And I, of course, hope and pray that nobody listening to this ever finds themselves as a hostage in that situation. But I think we're all going to face our own challenges and perhaps get into our own little prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that we work on our faith our entire life, the more significantly it will be there for us when we need it. We can't just magically expect that to happen. So that was very powerful to experience it in that way, and something that I try to share with others now.
Wow. And coming back, coming home, how have you seen that faith grow or that faith change? Because now you're not faced with as much crisis or conflict or fear, you know, how does it look different, or is it the same, or is it just, yeah, what does that look like?
I'll tell you, Mary, I will admit that during this time, particularly in the first month in solitary, I felt this closeness to God that I had never experienced in that way before. One of the most significant things that I think I learned is we're never less alone than when we're totally alone with God. That was what I really took away from this experience, because I felt this closeness that I had never felt before. And I have to admit, in the wake of this, I get almost frustrated, because I've had a hard time replicating that in my life today. And I think it's, I don't know what all the explanations are, but I think it's a lot of these things. I think it's a lot of distractions, a lot of things that are going on. And I'm sitting over here thinking, wow, I experienced this. I tasted this, and I'm still struggling to replicate it today in my life. And I think it's because of so many of the distractions. So I often challenge, you know, when I'm speaking, and sometimes this gets brought up in Q&As, I often challenge the audience to think about a time in their life when they felt the closest to God, the strongest in their faith. And what would it take to replicate that today? What are the barriers that are standing in the way of replicating that today or tomorrow, every day?
Right.
It's been a challenge for me, and something I'm working on, and something that I try to share with others today. So that's one of my key takeaways from this experience, is how do I replicate that?
Yeah. Oh, and I think it's also, I mean, it's real reality too. It's like our relationship's not going to be perfect, you know, for 80 years of however many years of life that we live. Like, we're going to go through these phases. And I think the fact that you're trying, you know, like that you're trying, and that you have that experience from those days that you're closest to him, you have something that you always want to seek again. You know, like, I think that's really powerful.
It's there. It's there. I'm trying to reach it. Yeah.
Well, isn't that
and I feel fortunate to have it there. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So based on your experience, and you mentioned your parents, like, instilling that faith in you when you were younger, so that when it came time to really, you know, embrace it, like you didn't struggle necessarily in that sense. What other advice would you give to parents who want to support their children through difficult situations, whether or not, you know, it's as severe as yours, or just even as they're getting to be adults?
Two quick things I'll say about that, and I'm not sure if I'm going to directly answer the question, but two quick things I want to mention. The two stories. So So I'm the oldest of five. As I mentioned, I have two younger brothers, two younger sisters, and I was the first to leave the house and leave, to go to college. I actually left to go play hockey for a year in between high school and college, but regardless, I was first to leave the house. And when I left, this was in 2007, my mom gave me this little, it was a piece of paper that she put in this small picture frame, and she wrote two bullet points on the piece of paper, and it said, go to mass, and number two was take care of the poor. And I need to maybe try to understand exactly how she boiled everything down to those 2 points, but she gave me those 2 points, and then subsequently to my four younger siblings, she also gave them the same thing when they left the house. And again, I don't exactly know how everything was consolidated down into just those two bullet points, but she gave me that and gave it to all of my siblings. And it's something that really stuck with me. And I think about those two things and the power of doing them. And that's been really, really meaningful to me. So I don't know if that's helpful to other parents, but it was helpful to me, and I think helpful to my siblings today. We're now, well past college and grown adults, but we still talk about those 2 points and oftentimes kind of joke about them, but also kind of reflect on the fact that we feel as if they were good things to say to someone at that age and leaving and going out into the world, so to speak. So when I think about kind of my parents and the way that they guided us on our faith journey, I think a lot about, it's kind of a micro thing, but I think a lot about those 2 points in that picture frame that my mom gave me that I still have today. The other thing that I wanted to mention, a quick story, is I briefly talked about this, but after college, so this is, 4 years, 5 years after I had the picture frame, I had this opportunity to go to Singapore, to move to Asia. And I was pretty unsure about doing this. Moving to Asia, it was a little bit crazy. And I was trying to decide what to do. I was grateful for the opportunity, but it seemed a little bit just extreme to do that. And I will never forget, my dad said to me, this was the summer of 2012, and I was debating, I had this opportunity for an internship with this civil engineering company in Singapore. I'll never forget, he said to me, as I was trying to kind of decide on this, he said, Sam, if you go to Singapore, the worst thing that happens is you just come home, and you can always do that. And that, I write about this in my book, because that safety net, as maybe I kind of view it today, is and became I view it as almost the foundation of my adulthood. It was the foundation of my professional career, of really becoming an adult and moving into my career. And I have the two best parents in the history of the world, but I don't think that my life, I may not have gone, I may not have gone to sing without him saying that and putting things into perspective that way. And so what does that mean? I mean, that was very, that was transformational for me, because I went and so many doors were opened. I lived, again, as I mentioned, I planned to only go for 3 months, ended up staying for 6 years, traveled to every country in the world. It all kind of started with that. And I truly may not have gone if he wouldn't have said that and wouldn't have kind of shifted my perspective and kind of viewed the risk as he viewed it and communicated it to me in that way. So again, what does this all mean? I'm not exactly sure, but I think there are parents who would have seen that differently. Maybe would have said, hey, you're out of college. You need to do, you need to get a real established, safe, not risky job now. You need to start thinking about things seriously. And I think, I think one of the biggest challenges that early 20-year-olds face today is a poor relationship with time. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is at that point, I'm kind of rambling now, but early 20-year-olds, you could do nothing right for the next 15 years and still be young.
Yeah.
Now I know people, they're going to do a lot of things right, but take risks, be creative, make mistakes. Mistakes are proof that you're trying. You don't have to be reckless or irresponsible, but I think that's the time to figure out what you want. And my father really encouraged me to do that. And I don't know that all parents kind of view that situation that way, but I'm so grateful that my parents did. And I would encourage other parents to think about things in that way, because it was meaningful and frankly transformational for me.
Well, and it allowed you, I think that's powerful, because it allowed you to make a mistake. You know, it's not like they were protecting you and keeping you safe and close and all that. They gave you that opportunity.
Exactly. You're totally right. They basically said, go and make a mistake. Mm-hmm. And then if you need to, you can always come home. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking like, wow, the worst thing that happens here is I end up exactly where I'm at right now. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't I go and do this? But I don't know that I would have been willing or comfortable. I still wasn't really super, you're still uncomfortable to do these things, but I don't know that I would have done it if I wouldn't have viewed it that way and thought, oh, this is worst case. Like I can be a little ambitious here. I can try to learn. I can, maybe take a little bit of a risk. And so I would encourage parents to think about that.
Yeah. And just to remember, like you were out of college at that point, right?
So your I had parents, just finished college.
Yeah. So your parents were really encouraging you to kind of take advantage of the experiences of life. And were there anything else that your parents did that, helped build this resilience? Like, it's just the idea of, I'm going back to your captivity, but like going through that alone in the sense of your isolation, and then also being removed from the isolation and into something, with multiple people, and just, I don't know what they said to you in the midst of all that. I'm sure it was, extremely difficult, but was there anything that your parents did gently or slowly, like you said, with the faith, like that helped build your resilience, that helped gave you that, athletic mindset that you were saying?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can pinpoint it to everything, but it was, our faith was just, it was consistently part of our lives. It was consistently part of everything we did. And I'm just so thankful for that. And it's interesting you kind of asked this, because my siblings are, we're having our own, I'm not married, but they're having their own families, and I have nieces and nephews, and they're, we're having these conversations amongst ourselves, like, all five of us looking around at like my siblings and I, we're kind of having these conversations, like all five of us grew up and have, some level of faith and relationship with God and go to mass, and five for five is just, frankly, in our society today, I think a little bit unusual. And we kind of look around and say to ourselves, like, what exactly did our parents do that resulted in this? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that any of us are really able to articulate it. Mm-hmm. I think the best thing that I can say is just the consistency. Mm-hmm. And if I get a better answer, I'm going to let you know, but I'm also going to going to communicate it to my siblings because we're having these conversations. So I, again, just comes back to me feeling so fortunate for the parents that I had. But I think it was just that consistent routine implementation of faith into everything we did, but in a practical way too. There's a balance, I think, between being faithful and practical and making that part of everyday life.
I want to kind of go back to your captivity, but just in the midst of, like, retrospectively, was there anything about how you handled the situation that was surprise to you? Like, when you look back at how you handled different aspects of that time, those 9 weeks, like, was there anything that you're like, whoa, I'm surprised that happened, or that's how I responded?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I don't know that I'm surprised. I will say, if things would have gone on longer, I don't know if I would have responded the same way. Probably would have ended up in some different situations, like psychologically and emotionally. Mm-hmm. I think for the time that I was there, between my faith and what I had developed from being an athlete, and also as an entrepreneur, there's a lot of skills. I worked to start a company in Singapore after that internship, and worked as an entrepreneur for 6 years, which is potentially the most challenging and complicated thing that I've ever done, starting a company, mm-hmm. and all the ups and downs from that. But I think just the background that I had from faith to business to being an athlete, mm-hmm. the way that I coped was just natural. That was how I was gonna deal with the challenge. Again, it was a very different challenge, and if it would have gone on longer, maybe I would have had to do things differently, and I don't know how that would have worked. But in the time that I was there, which felt like a very long time, I don't know that I'm surprised. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I'm surprised, just given my background.
Mm-hmm. Were there any moments where you were like, this is not, like, I don't know if I'm going to get out of here?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. I mean, there was the hardest part about the entire situation, particularly the first month, was the uncertainty of the situation. So I sometimes say to audiences, or just people who I'm talking to, I say, if I told you right now that you're going to go and sit in a Syrian dungeon 50 feet underground, no windows, all concrete, nothing but a small blanket to lay on the floor as a bed. You're going to get bread and boiled potatoes and water. That's it. You're going to hear people around you being tortured, but you're not going to be physically harmed. And on day 27, you're going to get out. Okay? I'm not saying that you would be comfortable, but what I am saying is it would be a totally different situation than not knowing if you were ever going to get out, mm-hmm. or not knowing. I was trying to entertain all of these different ideas from, you know, was I going to be there? Was I going to be released in a week? I thought that was possible. Was I going to be in that cell forever? I thought that was possible. Was I going to be released in 5 minutes? Were they going to open the door and shoot me or torture me or stop feeding me? Mm-hmm. All of these things, I believe, based on the information I had, were possible. Mm-hmm. And trying to entertain and process them 24/7 became emotionally and psychologically exhausting. Mm-hmm. And all of that is rooted in uncertainty, mm-hmm. the uncertainty of the situation. So that's why I say to people, if I'm not saying you'd be comfortable if you did this, but knowing that you're going to be out in 4 weeks, that's a totally different thing, having that finish line, than not knowing any of those things. So that was the most challenging part, was the uncertainty.
Yeah. And you had mentioned you could send out or listen to some communication and aspects like that. But ultimately, like, what did the save, what did you being released look like? What was that? How did that happen?
Yeah. So, my family were, the news of my disappearance was essentially learned through me going dark. I was always very good about keeping in touch, especially if I was in more of an unstable place. And I communicated that I was going to be there for just a few days. And when that time passed and they weren't hearing from me, they began to worry. And my family, again, normal, average family from middle America, weren't really sure what to do, but they took action and reached the U.S. government. Some of the highest levels of the U.S. government in Washington, D.C., where I'm at today, they weren't able to do, it's not that our public servants are incompetent or ill-intentioned at all. They just were handcuffed by a lack of diplomatic ties with Syria. So they weren't able to be super effective. And it ended up being a family connection through one of my sisters to the Lebanese government, who was able to mediate my release in Syria. So a little bit counterintuitive and unexpected, but it was actually the Lebanese who ended up mediating my release.
Just thinking about, you know, I don't know, just kind of as you now go out, you know, and speak to people about your experiences, but then also, you know, you are an entrepreneur, you know, you have all this experience. And when you speak to people, what are some things that they tell you about, like, that they're grateful for what you have expressed to them or shared with them?
So I speak to a range of different groups. My primary pillar is, as I mentioned, I talk about uncertainty. That's really, I talk about a lot. And I also talk about my faith journey through this, depending on who I'm speaking to. I talk a lot about the way we can lean into gratitude. That was helpful to me during my captivity. I talk a lot about how we can control the things we can control and let go of the things we cannot control. And then I also talk about recognizing uncertainty as an opportunity opportunity for growth. Those are my three primary pillars and takeaways, and that's what I really focus on. And the drama and the narrative and the story is really a mechanism through which to share the message. I work with CEOs and event planners or HR, who's ever managing an event, all the time. And essentially they say to me, you know, cool story, Sam, but what do we do with this, right? What is our firm? What is our real estate agency or our financial services firm or our, you know, our company do with this? And that's, those takeaways are really what my focus is today. And you know, people ask me quite a bit, Sam, if you could go back, would you still travel the way you did or still go on this trip? And on one hand, I would never want to relive captivity and wouldn't wish that on anybody. On the other hand, though, I would never want to, I think more importantly, I would never want to give up everything that's come from it. The opportunity to meet some remarkable people, to grow in character and in faith and in really just in understanding of the stuff in life that actually matters. And those two things go together.
Yeah. Well, and those experiences are beautiful experiences for people to say, oh no, like, I can be resilient. I can overcome this uncertainty, because, you know, you lived through one of the hardest things, and yet you're coming out and you're just being very, like, open about it. So
I'm trying, but I think uncertain times are exactly what we need in order to grow. And I experienced rock bottom teaching me things that a mountaintop never could. And I try to communicate that to others today.
That's great. Can you share with us a little bit? So you were a speaker, you talked about a little bit of your pillars. Can you share with us how our audience can find you, where they can, if you have any other resources that other than your book, and talk, and please share with us about your book too.
Yeah, thank you again, Mary, for having me on here. I'm really happy to connect. And if anyone wants to reach out, they can find me on social media. Please feel free to do that. As I mentioned, I have a book that is available online, being published by Hachette. It's about this story. Again, it's about the drama of some of these stories, but also what it means for all of us when we're facing uncertainty in our own personal, professional and spiritual lives. So hopefully, I'm optimistic about that bringing, it can bring value to readers in a range of ways, which I'm excited about. And I speak full time. I talk about this message. I talk about uncertainty, about how I was faced with life or death uncertainty. I thought I was going to be killed, probably in a pretty gruesome way. But what I've learned is that the same recipe or response is relevant to all of us when we're facing our own breeds of uncertainty. So between speaking and my book, that's where my time is today. But I would love to connect with any of your listeners, and please don't hesitate to reach out.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and helping us to understand better how to live through that uncertainty and just kind of maintain hope and all that.
My pleasure, Mary.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovshrine.org.